I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Great Plains Outdoors listeners, it's a great day out here on the Great Plains, and Rob and I are excited to be sharing another episode with you all. A little bit about what I've been up to lately. My husband and I just got back from Montana. It was our first trip there, both of us. We were in the Bozeman, Big Sky area, very touristy. We were absolutely loved it, and I was casually looking on Zillow every time I could to be like, I could live here. Turns out, probably couldn't. Need a few more zeros in the bank account, but it's a lovely countryside up there, and would definitely love to go back and do some fly fishing, chase some grouse around. I know a lot of my friends have been posting pictures of that here recently, so I definitely have a bucket list to go back and enjoy my time there. Rob, what have you been up to?
Yeah, Brittany, I have been running around doing the September stuff. We've been doing some horseback riding, getting in those last showdios for saddle clubs that my kids are into for the fall, getting some ranch work done, and my oldest boy is playing junior high football, so we're doing that. I have not yet been able to get out on any dove hunts or teal hunts, but I'm fixing to change that. So, you know, things are really rolling along on the Great Plains outdoors with dove season, prairie chicken season, you know, the huns, the prairie grouse, early deer season, whether that's archery or muzzleloader, you know, the early teal season. So it is a busy time of year, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's fun to see some of these youngsters. I know the Kansas youth season and the Iowa youth season are kind of right now happening, and it's fun to see these pictures come through online. And to give you guys a snapshot of what it's like to be friends with Rob, it's like we're casually having a conversation, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, gotta go. The cattle truck just pulled up, and it's click. And it's like that often, and I freaking love it, because I just think the lifestyle you and your family live are great. It's great. I adore it. So it's right. Good to hear that you guys are going to be getting out there soon and doing some dove hunting and stuff. Today we've got a pretty exciting guest with us, and I'm very excited to introduce her to all of you guys. First, she's quite dynamic in personality, and she's truly a trailblazer in the outdoor industry. And that's my opinion, but I'd like to think that most people who know her definitely echo that. Secondly, because she has a very important role with the Council to Advance Hunting and Shooting Sports. We are excited to share a little bit about her, but also with what the council does. They're up to some really great things, and let's get to know her a little bit. Taniya Bethke is the Director of Operations for the Council to Advance Hunting and Shooting Sports. She has a background in wildlife and conservation biology, environmental education, and community outreach. And she was the prior R3 coordinator for the great state of South Dakota, where she currently lives with her family. She actively builds relationships between people in the natural world in order to enhance understanding, transform perceptions, increase appreciation, and overcome barriers. She contributes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, we call that DEI, in the conservation community to ensure that all people not only feel like they belong in wild spaces, but they are welcomed there by others as well. She's a nature nerd from way back, avid outdoors woman, a mother of two vibrant, feral little girls, and wife to a rugged and equally feral Eric Bethke. Taniya, welcome to the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. We're glad you're here. I love the feral comment.
It is nothing shy of true. We definitely have some wild children and a wild man in this family. But thank you so much for welcoming me on your show. I'm so glad to be here today and excited to talk to you all. And for those of you that are listening right now, I have the great joy of knowing Miss Brittany French as well, who is a bright and shining light in the conservation world. And I'm excited to have a chance to talk to you both today.
Yeah, thanks for that. You're sweet. You're sweet. Let's hear more about you. Tell us about you. You were an R3 coordinator. What kind of started your journey in the outdoor world, Taniya?
Oh man. I started up camping with my family and having chickens and a goat named Dexter, who was a total pain when I was growing up. Did a lot of camping and backpacking and that kind of thing. But it wasn't until I moved to Pierce, South Dakota for this job to oversee all of the wildlife education programs for the state that I really had an opportunity to engage with other folks that represented my values in the hunting community. I had a lot of negative stereotypes kind of before I moved here about what that hunting community represented and what their values were. And I met some really kick-ass women who were all about food sustainability and loved hunting together and showed me how to process elk and chickens and deer and pheasants together. And we would all get together and have cookouts. And when I saw those values in them, I was like, yes, I see myself in that. And so now I'm proud to call myself a hunter, as well as an outdoor enthusiast and photographer, nature nerd, and the proud wife and parent to some nutso folks.
And oh yeah, that thing, by the way.
Oh yeah. Yep.
It's fun to hear, like obviously you've had like an identity in the outdoors before you moved to South Dakota, but it's cool to realize how much community makes a difference in that identity. I'm thankful for those women that you're around. That's really cool. I don't think I knew that about you either.
Yeah, it was wild. I just remember moving here and seeing not only that community of women, but some really impactful like role models and imagery early on. I remember seeing this image of a woman fly fishing with her kid in a backpack. And I was like, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yes, I could do that. I want to do that. I want to be that kind of parent. And, you know, having important role models and seeing representation at different points in my life has certainly been pivotal.
Yeah, I love that. I love that so much. And there's no doubt you'll raise those two little girls to be just like that too, I'm sure.
We'll see. There are some strong-willed people. Oh, trust me.
You want to go on record and say they get that from you or from Eric?
They get some solid dosage of that from both sides of their family tree.
Fair enough. Well, tell us all about the Council to Advance Hunting and Shooting Sports. I know this is it's a phenomenal organization. I feel like a lot of people aren't always aware of it. So I'm excited to let you share a little bit about what the council's mission is, how you guys came about, and what you do.
You got it. So the council's focus is to increase participation in and the support for hunting and the shooting sports. That's kind of the basic boil down piece of it. So not only are we interested in helping to educate the general public that may or may not choose to be firearm owners and may or may not choose to be hunters or recreational shooters on the importance of those activities as part of lifestyle choices like the ones that I've made, but also if folks want to try it out, to help make sure that the folks in the field who are offering programs and who are providing support have the tools they need to be successful to help increase participation. So the council itself creates resources for what we call R3 practitioners. So that those are the folks who are recruitment, retention, and reactivation focused in their jobs. And so they oftentimes work for states and nonprofit organizations and non-governmental organizations and do things like have supported hunts or teach folks how to recreationally shoot. And so we provide some best practices and research reports and results for those practitioners. We have trainings for them. We provide consulting work if they're creating R3 plans for their states or their organizations, and are generally there to, again, provide support and help remove barriers so those folks can be successful in their work.
It's such a big, important role in our outdoor industry. Like it's funny hearing you describe what you do, but I if folks truly understood like the work you guys do across not just, I mean, the whole United States, it's not just like one region. It's not like a specific cause. I mean, it's big. And you guys are traveling, you're hosting symposiums, you're providing resources. You guys just launched a brand new website and it's just phenomenal. It's chock full of resources where if you needed to learn anything about this R3 concept or anything about shooting sports and boating and outdoor recreation, like that's definitely, you guys are the resource for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the plug on there. We are definitely excited about being able to provide support. I think the folks that are the real rock stars are the ones on the ground. And if there's anything that I can do to help make their jobs easier or to provide them with resources to help them be successful, I want in. They're all doing good work.
So tonight, I'm curious, I guess, how did the organization come about? Obviously, folks are recognizing, and we can look at license sales and participation and tell that that those numbers are down. You know, there's some arguments to be made. It's like, are those numbers down across the landscape, right? Like the number of acres that we have access to hunt. I think we all also recognize that we're overcrowded on public land. So there's like this death by a thousand cuts, right? But your organization came about because folks recognized that there needed to be efforts to those three R's, right? Recruit, retention, reactivation. How did that happen? And then, you know, how are you funded? What does that look like? Just more about, I guess, the organization.
Yeah, thanks for those questions. And, you know, I'm certainly excited to talk about the importance of these activities in the broader landscape sense. And so, you know, access to wild spaces is something that's at the core value of what the council wants to provide for all people. And historically, it has not been the case for huge populations of folks. And so making sure that we are providing opportunity as practitioners to all people to get out and participate in hunting and shooting sports is really important. So that's kind of at the core of all of this. If it wasn't part of your family heritage, if it wasn't part of your community when you were growing up, it certainly can be part of your future. And we want to provide the resources for folks to not only start to engage, but continue to engage in those activities as lifelong choices if they so choose. In addition to that, we know that our populations are shifting over time. We know that our demographics are shifting as our country ages and evolves and adapts to folks that are moving in and families are moving all around our country. And so as a part of that, being inclusive of those diverse voices in the conservation space is what's going to make sure that hunting and shooting sports continue to be part of our American heritage long into the future. So now on the front of funding, multi-state grant funding is something that the council has recently added to their funding model. Historically, the council was kind of created to provide services to state agencies specifically and to help provide some guidance and support to them, and they were state funded through state agreements. That was kind of part of the historical model of funding, and those relationships changed and shifted over time. Through PR Mod, or the Pittman-Robertson Modernization Act, funding became available for multiple years to be applied to recruitment, retention, and reactivation activities in a new way. And so the council applied for a multi-year grant that we now use that funds our organization over the next, over within this 3-year period. And we'll continue to apply for that funding as we take a look at the future. So that funding allows us to provide services to states without having to directly charge those states. So we offer, like, we'll travel and provide guidance for our three practitioners, provide support for creating our three plans, provide support for holding our three summits, provide trainings for our three practitioners, all without having to be able to directly charge those states for those resources.
Gotcha. So would it be fair to maybe equate some of what you do as like a consulting firm almost to these states that are trying to put together R3 programs? They know there's funding available for that. They want to get all people that are interested in the outdoors access programs. You know, there's all sorts of barriers I think we can all recognize, but it sounds to me like you're consulting with those state agencies to help them with their programs.
I would expand that just a little bit, if you don't mind, Rob.
Sure.
I would say that we provide that support and help to remove some of those barriers for state agencies and NGOs and industry partners. And we are the conduit to help those organizations form relationships with each other to help build momentum as well. And then in addition to that, one thing that I personally love about some of the ways that our organization has evolved over time is that the council leans in on the hunting and shooting sports component. And we've got our companions on the other side, the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation, that provides guidance on the fishing and boating side. And so together as a team, we're able to, yes, consult with our partners and provide that consulting service, but also provide professional development, lobbying power, and support for removing those barriers collectively and nationally.
It's pretty incredible.
Thanks. It's fun. Yeah. I really love it.
Yeah.
I feel very fortunate.
Yeah. And the one thing I love too about the work the council does is I feel like you guys all have a good hand in multi-state grants, which we have talked a little bit about on our podcast. Our PR dollars, what the heck are they? Where do they come from? Who gets to use them and why? You guys kind of do a lot of that. You kind of not necessarily control, but moderate or at least connect people who have similar ideas and plans and concepts for multi-state grants. Do you want to talk a little bit about that or share some cool projects that are happening that might be a PR grant or just might be funded through the council or supported through the council, I should say?
Yeah, so the council is a partner in a couple of really fun projects I'm excited about. And we certainly help inform some of the priorities that our whole community is looking at. Like, we help identify what are some of the gaps of the work that's been done in our field and how can we all pull together and focus our effort in those directions. So we kind of facilitate some of those conversations, but the selection process for grants and the awarding process is separate from us. That's done by an outside entity. One of the things that I am excited about with where some of these funds are going are in things like the MAFWA diversity. MAFWA is the Midwest Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and they have recently pulled together to not only create a diversity and inclusion small game toolkit, which is a robust photo asset that represents people of color and women hunting in small game scenarios, which was a resource that did not exist in the Midwest prior to that toolkit. And it really limited the amount of outreach and representation that we were seeing in campaigns that states were being able to use to communicate with all sorts of audiences. So we created that toolkit, and now we can measure the efficacy of the toolkit in reaching those demographics and in seeing how that may impact those populations and feeling more included in this space, which has not historically been the case. Mm-hmm. So that's one project I love. Another one is the International Hunter Education Association and the Midwest Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies are working together on a major mentorship effort. And Brittany, I know mentorship is near and dear to your heart. And Rob, I'm sure if you're good with Brittany, you're a huge fan of mentorship as well. Mm-hmm. And that is another project that will help to connect folks that need more information and education with our more experienced folks in the hunting world. And so I think that project, again, funded by Pittman Robertson Funds, is one that's super exciting.
Yeah. And those grants too, Tanaya, you mentioned MAFWA. And so MAFWA is consistent of so many states. And in order for there to be a multi-state grant, you have to have so many states on board with that. So can you talk about how that kind of looks too, structure-wise?
Yeah, the product of that grant has to benefit at least 26 states, or it has to benefit the majority of a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service region, so over 50% of the states within one of those regions, or it has to benefit over 50 states within a regional association of state fish and wildlife agencies region. So in MAFWA, or the Midwest Association, for example, there are 13 states. And in order to be considered for funding, a project would have to benefit over half of those member states. So in addition to that, to receive funding, you would have to be a nonprofit, you'd have to be a state government, or a public or state-controlled institution of higher education. So those are the kinds of folks that are receiving funding. And then any one of those entities can partner with vendors to complete the projects, or research partners to complete the projects.
So Tanaya, I mean, it's obvious that you live and breathe this, right? And what your goal is, right? The R3 support. And I want to step around a question. I want to make sure it comes off the right way. But so, you know, all my life I've been contributing to Pittman Roberts, right? And I can look in the mirror and I can recognize that I am of the demographic of, I'm a middle-aged white dude, right? And so most of the people, the majority, right, if you just do the math, of the people that hunt and fish look like me. And I'm not saying that's good or bad or right or wrong or, you know, whatever it is. And I am totally all for inclusion, you know, all the guys that I hang out with and we hunt and fish and whatever. And when we hear about R3, you hear about recruitment, okay, and I get those programs. We need to get kids out, and I don't care, you know, what color their skin is, how they grew up, what their economic status is, that, you know, we need to recruit folks, men, women, boys, girls. We have retention, right? And so in my mind, we would say, let's look at the largest demographic, the majority, how do we retain those? And then we have reactivation. And so in my mind, you know, from a business standpoint, if you look at, if you were marketing as a capitalist business, and I know we're not doing that, but if you were to look at that as from a marketing standpoint, say, okay, probably the majority of the folks that have quit hunting, we want to reactivate them, or quit fishing, quit going outdoors, are probably middle-aged white dudes, right? We see a lot of programs that are geared towards getting women outdoors, getting minorities outdoors, getting, you know, young hunters and fishermen and ladies outdoors. What does that look like? What are some programs that you're familiar with that are saying, all right, the majority of the folks that are going to spend dollars are probably middle-aged white dudes, right? What does that look like for R3? Because I know there's a lot of folks that I hang out with like, yeah, R3 is great, but I don't ever see any programs for retention and reactivation of the guys that are the majority of the people that hunt fish.
Yeah, I think. So some of the things that you're translating are some of the biggest fears of our community, right? There's this sense that, like, if I see an investment in another population, that translates to something that I'm going to lose, right? There's that sense of this is all pie, right? And I'm going to lose my piece of the pie if somebody else wants to also participate in this space. And yeah. So I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I think it's an important thing to engage in. You're absolutely right that we have a huge population of Caucasian males that engage in these activities, and there is no desire of our states to want to lose that valuable customer base, right? R3 is about recruitment and retention and reactivation. And I would argue that the broad majority of funding that states spend on communication strategies are spent on their traditionalist audiences. Every email you ever get from your state agency is likely focused on your particular demographics and interests. And so that level of investment is very high from states, because they do care about your investment in our natural resources. Those are your reactivation, those retention strategies that come into your email box. The percentage of resources that states spend on diverse audiences are likely of higher profile. They catch people's attention because they look different, but also because they're not very common. They stand out when you see them, but they are infrequent and a smaller percentage of the investment. And so as we start to see an increase or evening out of those investments, that we're reaching all of our target audiences with the level of investment that's going to be effective, we're going to start seeing an increase in diverse imagery. We're going to start seeing an increase in diverse messaging. And so that's just part of the R3 community being responsive to this shift in our demographics. And it's part of an investment in the future. According to the US Census, the United States is going to be minority white as early as 2044. So if we look at our natural resources and the people who will be the stewards of those natural resources in the future, we have to start being intentional about how we're communicating and engaging with those broader audiences and how. So as I look at R3, you're right. It is all about recruitment and retention and reactivation. And it's all about how we engage our whole customer base. Not just one target demographic, it's everybody. How do we get new folks engaged and focused and interested in what we're doing and caring about what we're doing? How do we keep this valuable foundational customer base that we have? And how do we get folks back if we lose them because they are so valuable to us?
That was well said. I appreciate that. And I feel like you're right. I almost feel as if it could be a little Google ad-like, right? So all of a sudden you're searching, you know, new upland pants for hunting season like I did earlier. And all of a sudden I have 45 new ads popping up on my Facebook and my Instagram and on everything else about upland pants, right? I almost feel like that's kind of where we are too in DEI in the outdoor world, right? Where we're now implementing new, like, small game marketing toolkits. We're implementing these new products to where all of a sudden when you do see something different, it really catches your eye. And I think you're a little more curious, and then all of a sudden it comes up more and more and more. I would venture to say that's also the case in some of these situations.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah. New things catch your attention. Absolutely. And it may seem, if you're seeing it for the very first time or if it's being served up to you, that it's disproportionately happening more. But, you know, when I want to buy a yellow car, I see yellow cars all over the damn place.
Right, right.
When I'm looking for a red pants, man, I see red pants everywhere. And so your awareness, I think, is keyed into what you're paying attention to. But I don't want to shy away from the fact that our marketing depends on really effective retention strategies. Rob, to your point, really effective customer engagement for your current customer base and your lapsed customer base is a really important part of state strategies. And it's also the bulk of where their marketing funds go to. We are starting to see new strategies and campaigns emerge as our customer base diversifies. And so your awareness is going to increase as you see people being represented in new ways, certainly. And I will agree, one thing I didn't mention, a caveat, as we've inventoried R3 effort, there is still a disproportionate amount of effort put on, like when it comes to programs specifically, like the programmatic in-person part of R3, there's still a disproportionate amount of that that's done on the recruitment end of things. There are certainly fewer programs that focus on retention and reactivation. And that's a balance that the council is continuing to encourage the shift to happen. But programs aren't the only piece of R3. You've got programs, you've got regulatory shifts that you can make resources more accessible. You've got land acquisitions and access and programs that you can engage in to make sure that we can address some of the crowding issues that we may see on the landscape. There are lots of different ways that R3 comes into focus. Marketing and communication is a part of that as well.
We have conversations about that quite a bit with outdoor mentors, right? Because I would say, I mean, actually, if you would ask me 5 years ago when I got involved with it, it's like, oh, we're a recruitment program. We're recruiting young people. For sure. As we've done this for years and years and years, and we have approximately 1500 kids going through our program just this year alone, you kind of start to look at that like, well, maybe we're more of a retention program, because some of these kids have hunted with us not only for just, you know, a couple times, but for years now and a couple times each year. So I also think it's a shift in your mind too, like you could do R3 and do R3 every single part of R3 really well, but which one do you like really excel in and really focus on that? Because I would even say we recover all three areas, but we don't cover all three areas great, if that makes sense.
That's where the ORAM comes in. So this is technical R3 speak. I don't want to geek out too hard here if I don't, you know, if it doesn't make sense for the audience that we're serving. But, you know, every organization should be, and is being provided guidance to map up all your efforts on the outdoor recreation adoption model. And so see where are we meeting people at their very beginning of their pursuit of this activity, halfway down the pathway, or at the very end? And what are we doing to progress their skill sets so that they can go do this stuff independently? And so if we don't have any touch points later on in their career or later on in their pursuit of these activities, maybe we can diversify our efforts a little bit so that we're not just a one and done kind of engagement with folks and just leaving them with very little information and skill, but that we're continuing to kind of move everybody down the pathway a little bit. And it sounds like you've done that with Outdoor Mentors. I love seeing that on the landscape.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to talk through those things. And, you know, you kind of have to get to know your customer audience again, right? Like, yeah. It's very different when you're in my position. Like, one, I love the outdoors and I hunt and fish as a single person, yes. And I have feelings about what R3 looks like as that single person. But when you step into a role where you're responsible for a lot of other people, a lot of the kids, you know, the future of hunting and fishing, as I like to say, you do have to kind of really look at that and analyze it really well. Like, where are these kids coming from? And Rob, it kind of makes me think of what you asked Tania earlier. We have a lot of kids who come out and hunt with us who say, you know, well, my dad mentioned he used to hunt. Or my mom like kind of did when she grew up, but then, you know, they got a job and then they had kids and they moved across the state or they moved to a different state. And then, you know, money got tight. And then all of a sudden now that family doesn't hunt anymore. Right. So you almost are losing, or we lost, right? That's the point of reactivation, is we lost that population. And that, like, I mean, thinking about that, that could be like a huge program in itself, just to focus on reactivation of folks who have once done what we all love to do today.
Absolutely. I would say probably the majority of the guys that I grew up hunting and fishing with don't hunt and fish. If they do, it's maybe like one activity a year. It's like the annual, you know, opening weekend, Thanksgiving, we're home with the family, because they've lost access, you know, where they used to go, it's leased now. It used to be a lot more accessible for them. And what has taken the place of those activities are sporting events, and you know, I don't have any problem at all, and we're going to a football game tonight, but to enroll your kids into a traveling basketball league, a soccer league, a baseball league, a hockey league, it's easier. It's a lot easier than trying to find a place. Where can we go pursue ducks or deer? Or, and so if there's not a program, I guess that's where I was going with that. It was, we see a lot of funded programs and recognize that, you know, hey, it'd be nice if I could get out, you know, at least what I see from the agency in Kansas, you know, they have the special hunts that you can apply for. You know, I've applied for the Grand Osage special turkey hunt for 5 years, both as the youth with my son and then myself. I've never gone, you know, things like that, that it's like, there's just so much other opportunity that's just a lot easier. You know, it would be way easier to be like, well, we're just going to join the soccer league, or, you know, get in swim lessons at the Y or whatever. And, you know, yeah, we used to hunt and fish, but it's become inaccessible.
Yeah. I think one thing that's interesting about that, priorities are set by everybody, and certainly barriers are a massive part of what determines what your priorities are as a family. Like, it would be a hell of a lot easier for me to go buy chicken wings from the grocery store than go pheasant hunting, period.
For sure.
No matter where I'm going pheasant hunting, right? And so for me, it's a really important component to look at capacity on the landscape. I don't go out opening weekend. I wait to second weekend, and there's tons of public land opportunity in my neighborhood. You know, I think for my family, it's been a really important component to look at opportunity in a new way, because tradition, I think, oftentimes governs access in a lot of different ways. And I think breaking outside of how we define that can help enhance what's accessible to us. But I agree with you, like, crowding is certainly one of the major concerns of folks on the landscape, and making sure that we're opening up landlocked public lands is a major component that some of our partner organizations care very much for. And I think it's an important initiative. And states taking a look at access on private land and providing programs for those kinds of hunts is another important R3 initiative. One of the pieces I actually wanted to share with you is there's another research project that's not multi-state grant funded that Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation is heading up. And they're taking a look at this question, because there's some, I think there has yet to be a really enlightened or really detail-oriented research body of research developed around the concept of your social carrying capacity on the landscape, as opposed to the biological carrying capacity on the landscape. Like, I know waterfowl hunters, if they see another hunter at all or another vehicle anywhere in the general vicinity of where they're going to be, they're like, absolutely not. This is too crowded. I'm not going. Whereas I've seen people packed around a pond fishing right next to each other, everybody's reeling in fish, and that's not an issue. And so I think this idea of what we perceive as crowding, as opposed to what the land can sustain and what hunter perception about both of those things is a really interesting field of study. And so I'm really excited to see what the working group that's working with Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation on that project comes up with, because I think having some hard data to drive those decisions, it's going to be really helpful for us, and help point to some areas where perhaps we can enhance access further to address the exact concerns that you've got.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. We recently had a podcast episode about Cheyenne Bottoms, the largest, North America's largest inland marsh here in Kansas. And one of the things that the manager there spoke about was they had to change the hunting regulations on the marsh because the overcrowding by hunters was such that the birds quit using it. The largest inland marsh in North America, the birds quit going there because there was too much hunting pressure. Like, exactly. It blew my mind.
Yeah.
In my area, I'm in the eastern part of Kansas, and there's, you know, there's the walk-in program. There's a lot of that in the western two-thirds, but where I'm at, there's not much. And so there is a public wetland area 20 minutes from my house. And the last 2 years I've tried to hunt it, and every year I go, like on a Wednesday or a Thursday late season, there's 9 to 12 trucks in the parking lot, and you can look out across the water and I can see 5 or 6 guys decoy spreads from the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, well, you know, you're just gonna have shot raining down on you. And I mean, I've had it happen.
You in that situation.
Yeah. I mean, right. It's just like, it's not worth it, you know? Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, that idea of trying to use, if there's a way to use access as a recruitment, retention, reactivation tool, I think that's critical.
It's a huge concern. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, if you want to bring people into this activity, providing access and knowledge of where you can go and resources is huge.
Yeah.
And especially on our landscape here, one of the big things that's influencing waterfowl traveling through South Dakota is farming practices in North Dakota and climate change.
Yeah.
So we're seeing them using new pieces of the habitat in ways that they hadn't before.
Right.
And those aren't where the preserves are, and they aren't where historic hunting grounds are. Mm-hmm. And so here specifically in South Dakota, we've seen different patterning as a result of those kinds of things. And how we respond as a community is kind of up in the air and has yet to be seen. But right. It's interesting. I have no doubt that over time, access will continue to change, and it will continue to be an important focus of the work that we do with state.
And South Dakota has a limited draw for non-resident waterfowl hunters, right? Yeah. So, I mean, they're addressing access in that way. I mean, because in Kansas, you show up and there's, you know, we're a central flyway state and there's a lot of birds. And right, like I'm going to go to Wyoming and try and hunt elk. I'm gonna go to New Mexico and try and hunt elk, you know. So yeah, somebody's gonna see my license plate out there, but
I'm going to hold off on any opinions that I have on the non-resident draw, but I will say that South Dakota and Nebraska, also in the Central Flyway, recently did a really cool R3 initiative that I got excited about. They created a second tier licensing opportunity so that they called it the three splash, which is kind of a flippant phrase for it, but it's a two-tier licensing system so that if you're very skilled at your bird on the wing ID and you're a highly avid hunter and you want to go out in the field and you want to harvest a bunch of ducks and you know exactly which ducks are going to harvest and fill the bag limits, you participate in the first tier. But if you are a novice hunter and you're trying to learn your duck ID and you're engaging in a mentorship opportunity and you're just want to get some ducks and it doesn't really matter what you harvest, of course it matters what you harvest, but if your experience is not as experienced as folks that have really highly skilled waterfowl ID, you can do the second tier and it allows you to harvest three ducks without having to follow the very strict bag limit. And so it's a four-year study. They are taking a look at the impact it's having on more restricted duck populations, and it's had no negative impact so far. And it had a positive impact on the number of people engaging in waterfowl hunting for the very first time, because it is such a complex activity to get involved in for the first time.
Yeah.
So it's been really cool to see that positive impact. And it's across, you know, two states within the Central Flyway. And it was a regulatory change that had a positive impact on a population that had decreased or declined. So hunting population for waterfowl in South Dakota, resident population had declined 50% over the last 20 years. So participation mm-hmm. was really struggling.
Yeah.
So to see any kind of effort starting to increase the population of hunters while the duck numbers have been healthy across the whole state the entire time, that's been really cool to see. Mm-hmm. And we're happy about that.
Very cool. Good for them. That's great. I think that what that highlights to me, and just kind of like wrapping up this R3 like discussion too, is like, R3, yes, is going to always be recruitment, retention, reactivation, but as our landscape changes, as our population changes, I mean, R3 is going to change, right? Like recruitment will look very different today than what we'll be doing 20 years from now. Like mm-hmm. I have no doubt outdoor mentors will be here for another 20 years, and I know we'll be recruiting a different audience of kids. We'll be hunting on different places. And our mentors will look different too. Like every single layer will look so different. I guess I appreciate that about this conversation too, because one, it's open and honest, and I encourage any of our listeners, if you haven't had a conversation where you can just be like, well, what about this? And here are my feelings about that. Like I encourage you to, because it really makes you think outside of the box on what our future of hunting and fishing is going to look like and how you can be an active role in it today, not when you need to be 20 years later, right?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Brittany. And ultimately, we all care about wild spaces. We all care about wild things. And so making sure that the future of those wild spaces and those wild things is secured is, I think, one of the key pieces we can all unite over and take a look at what that can look like.
Yeah. I completely agree. We're getting ready to go to our first SCTP, which is Scholastic Clay Target Program practice this evening, where we created a inner city team with an effort to recruit a more diverse audience of kids. And a couple of our coaches are also from a diverse background, and it's been really humbling and very encouraging. I've learned so much from the kids and our fellow coaches, just what it's like to ask somebody that doesn't look like yourself to go shooting. I think that's always uncomfortable, right? Like, I'll be the first one to admit, like, I don't always know how to do that, but it's been really fun to just listen and learn from them. And like, yeah, I might be the more advanced shooter on the team, right? Or a coach on the team, but these kids are teaching me way more than I'm teaching them, which is just really, really fun.
Yeah. Having been someone that did not see representation of people like me in these activities my entire childhood, and now seeing representation and being able to be representation, it is so important. And the work that you're doing is awesome. So I'm excited to hear that.
Thank you. I'm curious, Anaya, what would be, I feel like your job is really fun. It's like very robust. And I know you do a lot of hard work with that as well. Like, like, you're the trailblazer for a reason. Like, you're putting in some major work. But what is your favorite part of your role with the council?
Lord, I love working to serve the people, the practitioners. Like, there's nothing that gives me more joy than helping people overcome historically insurmountable barriers. So if you got something you've been banging your head up against because it's not working, or you have an initiative you want to get done, and there are some old ruts that are keeping you from doing it, man, I love being a partner in overcoming those barriers and opening up new opportunities, creative solutions, and more inclusive spaces for all of Americans. That is the part of my job that I love.
Yeah, you're a good liaison for moving heavy boulders out of the road.
Thanks, that's a great compliment.
Like, how do you broker two words? Like, she's basically superwoman in terms of like breaking barriers, but also is like the most connected person I know. So there you go. Add that to your like LinkedIn bio.
I think I heard you just call me like really stubborn, and you asked me earlier where my little ones get it from. Maybe you're onto something.
I love that. Is there anything else the council is kind of up to here recently, or anything in the future that you want to share with us before we head into our lightning round?
I'm going to just take a shameless plug here to say that if you are interested in watching a PBS show called Into the Outdoors, the council helped Into the Outdoors create an episode on hunting and shooting sports. And we filmed in Ohio earlier this year, and it'll be airing on the PBS network and Into the Outdoors in October. So keep your eyes open for that. It's a project that's been near and dear to my heart, and we're very excited about we continue to do some storytelling around these really important activities.
Yeah, that's incredible. You'll have to share that with us, and we'll get it out to our listeners. I love that so much. PBS, I mean, wow.
Thank you. It was really fun, and there have been fantastic partners working with Into the Outdoors and Discover Media Works.
Very neat.
Let's do this lightning round. Bring it on. I'm ready.
Do we need to go over the rules and regulations that if you answer a question wrong, we come to your house and take all of your firearms?
We just take the labels off your canned vegetables and soup.
That too.
That's like my worst nightmare.
On the less extreme side of things, we also do that.
Well, my shotgun's name is Vera. She and I like to go for very long walks. It's a very personal, intimate relationship. So I'm going to be like really disappointed if Vera comes.
Stay away from my household is what you're saying.
Yeah. Don't take Vera, please.
This is a fun little 8-question game. We just like to get to know you better, get to know your passion a little better. I've come up with some funny, some serious questions, and you can just pick either or. If you want to explain yourself, feel free to. If not, you're good not to as well.
All right, let's go.
Hey, do this. So we're gonna tiptoe into this. Are you more of an angler or a hunter?
I am more of a hunter.
Ooh, that surprises me. I feel like I thought you were a bigger angler. Okay.
I love angling with my kids, but if I'm going to pick an activity I'm going to go do on my own, it's more likely to be hunting. And I'm the only hunter in my family. My husband does not. And so it's one of those things that I really love to go and do with my girlfriend.
I love that. We need to start our own podcast about how our husbands don't hunt. That'd be kind of fun, actually.
Game on.
I'm not sure how they'd feel about it, but Ben has gotten to the point where he's like, I just feel like I'm like the queen when Brittany starts talking about hunting. Let's just like smile and wave, smile. He'll be like, where do you want me to put this like bullet slug thing? That's another rabbit hole. That's another rabbit hole.
Yeah, right.
Great guy. Love him to death. That's another rabbit hole we can go down. Okay. So you're headed out for a free weekend with your family. Are you guys going camping, hiking, sitting around by the fire? Or are you guys going to go explore maybe a cute new town, hit a farmer's market, participate in some community events?
I'm going to answer both of these sides of the question. We are most definitely broad majority of the time going camping, hiking, sitting by a fire. That's big for my family. We do that as many weekends as we can. And my husband and I are getting our first trip away from the kids coming up at the end of October. And we're going to go see Lizzo live in Denver for Halloween. So there's that.
So, much. So you're going to dabble in both. I appreciate that. I do. Yes. Okay, so favorite game to hunt. Are you a big game hunter or are you more focused on bird hunting?
Oh, my favorite season is dove season. Hands down, I love dove season. Nice. Now, I am a big game hunter. I love pheasant hunting too. But no, my favorite hunt is a dove hunt.
Says somebody from South Dakota. That's pretty
I know.
Wild. Yeah.
I feel like
the when I'm a hunting people, capital of the world.
I know. Isn't that blasphemous?
Yeah, I won't tell anybody.
Thanks.
We'll just air it on the podcast. At least. Yeah. So that answers my next one. So I'm going to pivot. If you had to pick between two types of bird hunting, would you choose upland or waterfowl hunting?
I would pick upland for sure.
Figured so. I tell people that dove hunting is one of my favorite and they kind of look at me like, why? Like you got to shoot like a million of them to even get a meal out of it. It's fun. Probably it's like the one thing you can be really chatty while doing and not ruin the
It is social. And I will say some of the most meaningful hunts I've ever been on have been big game hunts. But like if I had to pick the thing that I just love doing just casually, it's dove hunting.
I love that. Love that. All right. Let's talk about your gym routine. Are you lifting and throwing heavy weights around? Or are you doing some cardio to a Lizzo song?
Thanks for asking. You guys, I am so excited. I started powerlifting this year for the very first time in my life. So in April, I started lifting with JR. He's a world powerlifter.
Wow.
And he's very tatted up. It's great. But I weaned off my second daughter from nursing. And I was like, I'm going to reclaim this body and see how strong I can get. Mm-hmm. And y'all, I'm so excited. I'm going to lift in my first powerlifting competition in October.
Wow.
In November.
Wow. All right. Add that to the resume. Going to be on PBS and casually lift in a powerlifting competition. All right.
If you just like ever come up to me and squeeze my arm and be like, wow, that would make my year. You don't even know. I don't have big arms at all. But the fact that I have a teeny tiny bump there right now, I was like, I worked really hard for that bump. I'm so proud of my little bump right now.
I earned this. Well, that's going to be the first thing I compliment you on the next time. Whether it's in a math room of 400 people or not, we're just going to roll the dice and see.
Oh, God, this is why I love you. I also, coincidentally, while we're oversharing here, I grew an extra inch and a half of butt since I've been powerlifting. My husband, I told him, again, we don't do a lot of like lifting or gym time together at all. Yeah. But I came home the other day and I was like, honey, this investment has been worth it. You're welcome.
You are welcome. This investment, I love that. I'm doing this for you.
No. This is all for me. There's some side benefits, however.
Oh, I love it. I love it. All right. Let's talk about music. Are you going to be the mainstream listening to Lizzo, right? Like you mentioned, you're excited about that. Or are you kind of going to be the girl that's always got the throwbacks, like the 90s, maybe some 80s jams coming up on your...
No, wait a minute. The 90s or the throwbacks?
What? Yeah, I don't understand. I'm with Rob on that one. So if I'm jamming out to some throwbacks, I am jamming out to Motown. So the other thing that we're doing while we're in Denver is we're going to go see Ain't Too Proud, the Temptations musical. And that's my realm.
Wow.
Like dancing and singing to Motown music with my mom in the kitchen. And that's my jam. I'm a big Motown fan.
That's a dream. I love that. And I can appreciate that because usually when I say throwback, I'm the girlfriend that my friends make fun of because my iTunes will come on shuffle and they're like, are you 65? And I'll be like, Yes, I am. My soul is 65 years old and I don't understand rap and I struggle with some other mainstream stuff. And so when I say throwback, I have to be careful with that because what's throwback for me is that Motown, even though I'm, I was born in the 90s. I love that. Well, good for you. Okay. So you got your shotgun in your hand, you got your beer in your hand, right? Do you prefer trap shooting, skeet shooting, or sporting clays?
Sporting clays, hands down. I love sporting clays so much. Not great at it by any stretch of the imagination. I've got a long way to go, but I do love
sporting clays. I'm with you. Yeah. I get tired of the five position. I mean, it's fun, but I would much rather shoot sporting clays.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm too much of a super athlete in terms of if I can't hit all five targets in each spot over and over again, I don't want it. Like, like it's like the game of golf. Like I'm very competitive when it comes to golf and trap is not good for me. Trap shooting's the same thing.
Yep, I'm with you. The variety that comes with sporting clays is really fun.
Yes, yes. All right, our last question here. Okay, so this one's kind of fun, and I think we all probably know the answer to this, just if you've listened to this far into the podcast. So we're in a moment in time, not that we've had any of these lately, where we can all make a really big difference in the world, right? Like lots of big things happening. Are you going to be the person to, you know, stand up and facilitate the hard conversation? Or are you going to be the person to kind of take a, not a backseat, but a second role, listening role, and a supportive role?
Oh, that's a great question. While I think both of those pieces are key components to being a really good partner in this space, listening to people and finding out what their barriers are and then helping to empower and uplift and overcome is a huge important part of what I do. But I will not sit idly by if I hear, oppressive or negative conversations happening in this space.
Yeah.
I that's probably not a surprise to anybody.
No, nope. I love it though. I think we all have our strong suits. So I think it's really good that, I mean, you know yours and you're really good at it. That's great.
Thanks,
like, you passed with flying colors. We're not going to take the label off your vegetable can.
Oh my gosh. Honestly, that's like one of my worst nightmares right there is not knowing what's in the can.
Oh, I love it.
What do they call that? The tradition you go to somebody's house after they've got married and you do that?
White elephant? Oh, I don't know what that one's called.
I don't know, but I never understood that. Why would you go to a newlyweds couple's house and just like mess it all up? Like, we love you so much. We're going to make your life heck.
Yeah.
Welcome to goulash hell for the rest of your marriage. Or like vegetable roulette. I don't know what you call that. Yeah.
Looks like we're having tomato soup tonight. I thought it was corn.
Could be applesauce. Yeah. Could be peas.
Yeah.
Oh, Lordy. Well, Tanaya, thank you. So much fun. Yeah, thank you so much. How can folks connect with the council? How can they find you online? What's the best way to get a hold of you if people want to?
Please check us out at CASS.org. That's CASS.org. Or find us on Instagram or Facebook at Thanks for Hunting, and four is the number four.
Cool.
We'll be sure to share all of those too when we post this episode up.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tanaya. Hey, and I always like to try and close these episodes out and encourage folks to get involved in one of those NGOs out there, whether it's Pheasants Forever, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Delta Waterfowl, Ducks Unlimited. They all do great things for access, for habitat, and you know, find something that fits you, get involved, and get out there.
Absolutely.
Amen.
No time.
Thanks for having me, y'all.
Yeah, thank you. Y'all have a great day.
We'll see you.